2024, the time is 6:30 p.m. Calling to order the City of Centerville City Council meeting. First order of business is roll call. Councilmember Sweeney.
Here.
Councilmember Mosier.
Present.
Councilmember Koski.
Present.
Councilmember Taylor.
Present.
Junior Councilmember Stauber.
Here.
And Mayor Love is also present. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you all. Next order of business is approval of the agenda. Does any council members have any items that they would like to have added to the agenda this evening? Does the staff have any items to add to the agenda this evening?
We do not.
All right, hearing no additions, would anyone like to make a motion for approval of the agenda as presented?
So moved.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Motion carries. Next, we move into our appointments and presentations, and the first item of business is the Emergency Medical Services Annual Report from mHealth Fairview. We have two gentlemen here this evening. All right. So doubly special.
Mr. Mayor, council members, thank you for giving us the opportunity to present our activity for 2023 and answer any questions that you might have. I'm going to be presenting some of the statistics, and Kevin's going to fill in with a little bit of color some of those things that are outside of just pure 911 responses that we enjoy participating here in town. In front of you, or up on the screens, is our annual report. We look at two numbers. One is what we consider our northern region altogether, and that includes Centerville, Hugo, Forest Lake, Wyoming, Scandia, and kind of throughout the region. We like to put things into perspective because it is such a wide span of land and response times. We want the ability to compare one municipality to another, knowing that our municipalities here are very unique, very distinct in size, shape, distance, and whatnot. I won't bore you with all of the statistics, but we'll look at 2023 kind of in summary. In the first page, it is looking at numbers for our entire Northern Territory. Busy year, 4,910 emergency responses. These are responses coming through via 911. Only a small drop from 2022, essentially about the same number of volume. Of significance, mutual aid has been a hot topic of conversation throughout the entire metro area. COVID put 911 into a spin across the country. Our metro area is not spared of that, and it really threw off all of our responses and how we respond and what our models are. It created an opportunity that we're now starting to capitalize on more, and that's formalizing mutual aid agreements, making sure that EMS organizations are talking to each other, strategizing with each other, making sure that we're taking care of the residents of our greater metro area. We have two numbers down there. Mutual aid that we have received in our northern area was about 216 times we had to reach out to other EMS providers, and then 406 times other providers reached out to us asking for assistance. That number from 2022 was down just a little bit. We're getting into our new norm, getting COVID past us, and we're seeing mutual aid still elevated from what we had seen in 2017, 18, 19, but this is our new norm, and we think it's a good thing. We think, well, you may see different logoed ambulances in your municipality, it's a good thing. We're here to make sure that we're getting the lowest response times as possible, and where we can share resources, we're doing it with a more proactive approach instead of a reactive approach. Our average response times for the entire northern region for emergent calls, these are where we're responding lights and sirens, was 8 minutes and 20 seconds. And those less urgent calls that were not using our lights and sirens and were obeying all the traffic signals was 8 minutes and 53. If we go to the next page, these are statistics that are unique to Centerville. In 2023, we had 276 total 911 requests. That was up about 57 calls from 2022, a little bit busier in Centerville. Our mutual aid responses, our requests were about the same, no significant change there. And when it comes to our response times, that's where our residents are, their perception really matters, and that we try to keep a really close focus on. We had a slight increase from 2022. An average for our emergency was 7 minutes and 38 seconds. That was about 40 seconds more on average per call than 2022. In our non-urgent, non-lights and sirens, we had an increase of about 28 seconds. That was about 8 minutes and 6 seconds. These is raw data. We don't scrub our data. We do look at our outliers. We look at those responses that are statistically very, very short, and those that are statistically very, very long, to make sure that those are accurate. Again, we don't scrub them, we leave them in, but we leave them as discussion points. So the data you see here is the raw data. So is there any questions that I might answer regarding the data before Kevin kind of presents some of the other activities we have here in town?
Seeing council members have any questions?
Thank you very much.
The one question I would have is, you noted an increased call volume year over year. Do you know what you attribute that to?
We track call types, the calls that the medical complainants coming in via the county dispatch centers, or in some of our northern territories, some of those 911 calls are being routed directly to our health dispatch center, which is a 911 PSAP. We are getting usually the very first complaint that comes out of the caller, it may be a fall. It may be a fall related to a cardiac problem, but what we see in our tracking via the data we get from the dispatch center is simply a fall. So to answer your question, we do see that falls are one of our number one calls, and it's very consistent over the past several years. Mental health and crisis calls is usually number two. Up and down, but we didn't see a significant change there. What we are seeing more of a change in, and this is trending over 2020, 21, and 22, is that the urgency of calls is going up slightly. People are waiting longer to call 911. And when they're waiting longer to call 911, it's leading to more complications. You know, EMS is the safety net of healthcare in many communities and many people. And the safety net becomes that last-ditch effort to get health care, and again, we're seeing some increases in the urgency of that patient, the complications of that patient.
Mr. Mayor, when you're done, I have a few, if you could.
Yeah, just my follow-up call or question regarding the numbers is, I noticed that there's such a small number of transports in comparison to the overall number of calls.
There is a number there, and we could certainly illustrate on it, is the number of non-transports, and you see that in line, looks like about line 6, 63 for the year. That was an increase, 63 non-transports. These are many times opportunities that the crew shows up on the patient scene, they evaluate the patient, and they're able to provide interventions. It may be just giving care, it may be giving a handhold, or maybe giving medications that improves the patient's condition to the point where they don't need to be transported to an emergency room. Maybe they can make an appointment with their primary care physician in the morning. These are conversations that are taking place between the patient, the family, the crew, and the medical director. That's not our ambulance crew making these final decisions. But many times that's really what the patient needs. Sometimes while that's great care for the patient, they get to stay at home. We're not overburdening the ERs too much, because they're in crisis, as you probably hear on the news. But these generally take a long time. So it does take a resource out of our deployment. It's a valuable time, though. We look at those as encouraging, as long as they're done and managed appropriately. Good communication with our medical director 24/7. Those many times are best for the patient.
And that was going to be my follow-up question, if there was still value to that. So
there's a tremendous value to that. It's something that, as an industry, we're promoting. It's best for the patient. It's best for our ERs. It's best for the resources. We do have some issues on the other side. We can't bill for those. So we can spend 20 minutes on an urgent 911 call, get to the hospital and be back in service. But if we spend 40 or 60 minutes with a patient and we don't transport, then there's no way to recoup that. There's no revenue to offset the payroll, the medicines used, the diagnostics used. That's a challenge that our industry is working hard on.
Thank you. Well, we'll let the council members go first.
I don't know how you'd answer this question, but maybe if we, it might be page 3 that we're not privy to, but what kind of revenues and dollars flow through this business? When you said you couldn't recoup and stuff, you know, that 20 or 60 minutes, is there...
It's a tough question to answer.
I imagine it is, but there's got to be some dollars there because...
A lot of our elected officials are asking that question, and there is no simple answer. There's a lot of simple takeaways, but there's no simple answer. In 911, when it comes to billing, we bill the end user. We bill the patient if we transport the patient. There is no tax revenue. There's no tax dollars. There's no tax subsidy from the local governments, the state government, or the federal government that helps support mHealth or any other non-municipal ambulance service.
But there's also no mandates on how much you can charge for the service either, is there?
There's no mandates. There's no mandates. But there are ceilings. Medicare sets a ceiling. Medicaid sets a ceiling. You cannot bill higher than what Medicare says. You can create a price tag, if you will, and say this price tag is going to be $35,000. But if 60%, and that's pretty typical of what we bill as Medicare patients, 60 to 70%, it doesn't matter what we put on a price tag. It's completely irrelevant. It's what Medicare is willing to pay. That's set by the federal government. You cannot bill and offset that. If we were to set our price tag at $35,000 and Medicare is only paying $100, you don't get to bill the patient for the difference unless they have a Medicare alternative. Then there may be some supplemental. But generally speaking, what we do is we look at what is Medicare, what is Blue Cross and Blue Shield going to pay, what is Aetna and United Healthcare, what are they reimbursing for various ambulance transports? And then we set our level there. It makes no sense for us to set a number higher, particularly with non-Medicare, non-Medicaid. This is where it can become really quite unethical, setting a super high price tag and then sending that patient, that customer, who is now our customer, sending them a bill for the difference. Medicare, Medicaid, you can't send them the difference. But in private, you can. And that's where it really comes to ethics, is do you set an ambulance bill at $5,000 or do you set the ambulance bill at $2,000? And I can't answer that question. I can say what we say is right around $2,000 for an ALS ambulance plus mileage. What Medicare pays is closer to $500 or $600. It's about 60 cents on the dollar for Medicaid straight. If we include Medicaid, when you're looking at EMS organizations in areas of high populations that may have higher Medicaid patients, then the reimbursement is less than 60%. It can be closer to 40%. It's far less recouped than it costs us to do one transport.
Yeah, you know, you kind of answered my one question there, and that is, what is a higher call volume mean to you, other than, I mean, obviously expense, but yeah, kind of how do you recover that in your transport, non-transport kind of?
What mHealth is really, really good at, and a lot of the other hospital-based ambulance services around the state, is being able to balance that interfacility demand, moving patients from one hospital to another, or discharges to nursing homes, extended care centers, or back to the patient's home, and flex that with the 911 demand. We could put up, at peak volume, based on our statistical analysis, we may put up 32 ambulances in the greater metro. And based on volume at the moment, say we're going to lean some ambulances over towards the university campus and some over towards St. John's. They're getting very busy. Rosemont or Burnsville Ridge is one of the busiest emergency rooms in the state. And we can flex those ambulances to take care of those patients and give them as close to a great response time as they would expect. We all want ambulances, or we want our healthcare to progress instantly. That's not a possibility. But we can offer great times to move these patients so they're not waiting. Or if they're critically, and there's a medical need to get that criticality, get that ambulance there, we can flex. But we also have the ability to tell those patients who are stable in a bed, under the care of a doctor and a nurse, and say, they're going to have to wait 30, 45, or 60 minutes because we're going to flex those ambulances back into our 911 territories. That gives us the flexibility to do that. Others that don't have to rely purely on mutual aid. That's the economy of scale that allows us to do our job efficiently and effectively without having to cut corners. If you've seen our ambulances, they're pretty big, they're pretty bright. The inside is the absolute state-of-the-art equipment. The only other way to operate effectively and be able to work within those tight margins that the state and local governments and some of the Blue Cross Blue Shield, which we have no impact on, they get to make up their own rules, is to cut the fringes, to cut the greatness and come back to good. You see a lot of organizations and other municipalities that have to cut education to the bare minimum. They have to buy the minimum cardiac monitor. Our cardiac monitors have artificial intelligence. They have at the moment coaching to the EMTs and paramedics, from CPR, pacing and depth, to providing ventilations at the right pace and the right depth. It's giving them real-time information. We pay an exorbitant amount of money for that, but we're able to do that because of our economy of scale.
And two more questions. And one, are you getting hurt by the, employment shortage or employee shortage? Is it hard to find and recruit?
We were through 2022 as we were coming out of COVID, and ambulance call volume, 911 call volume dropped dramatically during the 2019, 20, and 21 all across the country. It seems to be quite ironic. You have a deadly disease hitting us in a pandemic, but our 911 volume dropped. People were staying home. They were staying away from areas that they thought might contribute to them getting sicker. With that, we had the ability to, through attrition, kind of scale back. We didn't have to lay anybody off. We can scale back. We can reassign to ERs and to ICUs that may be short-staffed. We also know that our onboarding process is extraordinarily long. When we hire a new EMT or paramedic, it's 4 to 6 months before they're fully capable of running on the ambulance. So we knew we were going to play catch-up. We were in that environment of we have more call volume than we can handle. Our mutual aid request went up. Now we're short. We're very, very close to being fully staffed. Our headcount, we were applying for one paramedic, one EMT, and one wheelchair van driver. And then the chief, looking at the budget forecast for 2024, and said, let's add 4 more FTEs. I was this close to being fully staffed.
Then the other last question I had is, you have, and I just saw him pull up out there a little bit ago, where you station or out of here. Is there anything that we can do here as a city? How's that working out for you? Does it benefit you? Is there anything more that we can do to provide as a city?
Kevin is our district chief. He is responsible for our northern territory 24/7. He's stationed up here, moving around. His partner Clayton is here. If you haven't met Clayton, he's actually out in the car. I'll let Kevin attest to that. Our ambulance crews, anytime they have the ability to sit down out of the elements and stretch their legs, that's a great thing. But we wouldn't ask for anything more. Some of the amenities of being able to get the ambulance out of the elements, particularly in the winter, those are great things. We really get a lot of value at it. But our ambulance crews also know that what working environment they're in, what they chose to kid into was, you may be in your ambulance, either the front seat or the back seat, for 12 hours straight, or 13 or 14 hours on a 12-hour shift. But we appreciate the relationships. I think the most important, most valuable thing a crew gets is when they feel like they're part of the community. So if you hear the opportunities through your schools, your churches, your other social groups, that an awareness, an ambulance, we call them show and tell, sometimes for young kids, sometimes for adults, opportunities for touch a truck, parades. I love parades. I will sometimes drive the ambulance in the parade. Fireworks standbys. We have a lot of opportunity to connect with the community. And when the crews truly feel that they're part of the community, it's really one of the biggest benefits.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll let Kevin speak to some of the other activities.
I had a couple other questions. Mark, did you have a couple?
I do. Sorry. I'll keep you up here just a short time. The fire service recently, our fire service recently changed their responding protocols to drop some of the lower priority medical calls. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to check in with you to see how that's going and whether or not you think it's still appropriate and whether or not that's been, hopefully they've been collaborating with you to let you know that was coming and all that kind of stuff.
They have. I haven't seen any issues and no issues have been reported to me as far as like the acuity that they're going on. Our staff are very familiar with variability with that subject because the different communities all respond to different calls from a fire service standpoint. So when they get a rescue truck there, it's a good day, you know. So, but they're used to working, you know, by themselves or with law enforcement or something like that. So, the changes that you're discussing now haven't seemed to affect us.
Good. I think I'll reserve my comments till the end of the rest of it.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you again for having me. Kevin Kane, District Chief of EMS, as Tom alluded to, for the northern region here. I'll be fairly brief here. A few things that I wanted to talk about outside of the data is just some of the community engagement projects and things that we're involved in. And as Tom said, the more of that we can get involved in, the better for everybody. But historically and annually, we've been part of the Festival of Lakes. I don't try to say the word, so...
That's a lot.
Okay. I've mispronounced it so many times, I reserve my... but we are certainly a part of that. Last year, the Trunk or Treat, I think it was the second annual Trunk or Treat. Mm-hmm. I heard we need to step up our game as far as decorating the ambulance. We thought it would be scary enough just to see the lights and sirens, but I was told that's not so much the case. And then this year, we just recently got contacted about the Main Street Market Kids Night. So we'll be a part of that in what capacity, we're still working out, but excited to be a part of that. One of the things that I do up in this area is make sure that I'm in constant communication with whether it's chiefs or some sort of fire and police leadership, so that when we come and present at a meeting such as this, that there are no surprises or that we've worked through any issues and or things that are really going well and make sure we sustain those. So with Centerville specifically, Darren Eckert is kind of my point of contact now. Historically or previously, it had been Chief Peel and I had worked together closely. So we sit down and it's a mixed bag. Sometimes some of the other fire leadership are there. Sometimes it's just Darren and I, but we talk about this data when it's necessary, and then just go through, you know, calls that have happened, how did things go, any concerns, any problems, and then again, we'd love to hear the kudos as well because nobody hears that enough. So I bring that back to our team and let them know, you know, this was a positive interaction with fire and police. And then he said, I have a partner in the car. It's not a human, so that's why they're still in the car. But Clayton is our facility dog. He's a task trained. He was training to be a service animal and went through and graduated that program. And when we connected with Can Do Canines out of New Hope and presented this idea of having, call it a therapy dog, call it a facility dog, there's all these labels, but basically his role is to provide therapy or comfort for the EMS staff. So as his handler, he comes to work with me every day. He's got a vest and a badge and all that stuff. And he also comes out to our community engagement activities when possible. But he's usually the first request we get is, hey, can Clayton be there? Also, Kevin, could you be there?
Can Kevin drive Clayton?
Yes. So if you see him or us out and about, make sure to say hi. And again, if you think of any community type activities that that would be good for, we've got a Forest Lake High School, Forest Lake Middle School, all the time. And we're there, and it just breaks down that barrier with adults and students alike. You know, we can kind of talk about EMS as a profession, and as well as just kind of letting them know that it's a trusted adult that's coming potentially on a bad day for them or their family. And Clayton has done a wonderful job in the last 2 years, really kind of facilitating that. So much so that we got a second dog down at based in our St. Paul location, from Can Do Canines. Again, it's a nonprofit company that trains, it breeds and trains service animals. So it's been a great program. Any questions for me?
Awesome. Questions? Mark?
Yeah, just a final comment. I just wanted to remind the council, because we have some new faces on the council that maybe weren't here a few years ago when we made the change to mHealth, but the world of EMS is a complicated one in terms of how it's set up in state law, and it's being debated at the state legislature right now, so pay attention to that. You know, they're always talking about that, changing some of those things, because we've, like a lot of different industries, had crisis with staffing and all this kind of stuff. But we're one of the very few communities that has a choice in who we use for our EMS. So we have a choice between Allina and mHealth. And a number of years ago, we chose to go with mHealth, mostly based on the fact that they were committed to being here and sort of stationed here. Of course, that doesn't mean they're here 24/7 just waiting for a call. They got to be out and about and around and that kind of thing. But they are, you know, based right out of our garage here, and that felt good to us. And the response times you see bear that out. You know, if you look at our fire response times to incidents as well, you'll see that we've got a pretty good, along with our police, just a three-pronged approach that if you call 911, you get help under 10 minutes, and you probably got three different agencies there under 10 minutes. That's pretty doggone good, and we're glad to see the numbers that you guys have showed us, and I just want to thank them for their partnership.
Yeah, the only thing I was going to add to that, so pretty amazingly, we were at the Capitol last week, and one of the big discussion topics was EMS, and they were, just like Mark said, and we happened to have opportunity to run into the governor, and the governor said, yep, I know the availability of EMS is a big issue for you guys. And I got to look him right in the eyes and say, not for us. That's not our main issue. And he kind of had a little surprised look on his face. I said, no, EMS is fine and cerebral. I said, now fire, we can talk about, you know, how we need to do regional fire, but EMS is not our issue. So it was very good to be able to say that, very humbling, very, you know, I felt very blessed to be able to say that we have a great partnership with
you. Thank you, Josh. It's a hot topic, and this week is getting hotter. We don't want to politicize anything. EMS in the state of Minnesota is very unique. EMS across the country is unique. There is no one model. There's no one gold standard. There could be 100, there could be 1,000 gold standards that all have great clinical and not great clinical outcomes and all look vastly different. So I would offer up our time and our information if you have specific questions of what EMS is for mHealth, what EMS is for the state of Minnesota. We can provide you with information, clarifying information, so that if you do have to make decisions, you do have to choose, or you're given another opportunity, that you're making it with real facts, real raw data, and that it's not politicized. Right. We're always available to answer questions. We can answer from a couple of different perspectives. Police and EMS relationships. Kevin is one of our experts. He's one of our SWAT medics. He is our liaison to a lot of our police departments. And I am the newly elected vice president of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I can speak in that role. I can also speak in an mHealth role. I've been in EMS for 34 years, working in highly competitive, hyper-competitive markets like Chicago, Detroit, and I'd be happy to offer any insight. We don't want to steer, we just want to make sure people understand what are the particulars, what is really at issue, what is not at issue, and make sure that people are making the right decisions for their communities every community around the state is very different.
Very true.
So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
All right. As we move on through our agenda tonight, the next item of business is resignation of Planning Commissioner Linda Broussard-Vickers. Mark, I don't know if there was anything specific other than us recognizing Linda that we wanted to do this evening?
No, this is a formality, really, to accept her resignation. I think everyone should just know that Linda took the position knowing that she was ready and willing to give it up as soon as there were interested people. There was just a hole there, and she, being a longtime resident and, you know, former planning commissioner and former city council member, felt an obligation to fill that gap. Well, there was a gap, and as soon as she learned that there were some interested candidates that were qualified, she said, gladly step aside. And, you know, she also snowbirds a little bit, and so that was, you know, being tough to manage that, so.
Yeah, well, I just want to take this opportunity to publicly thank Linda. I mean, she has stepped up many times over the years, as you just noted, planning and zoning, city council. She is a great member of our community. We dearly appreciate her, and we will miss her knowledge and her skill and her passion for planning and zoning and for our city. But as her resignation said, if we need anything, give her a call. So we know she's not too far away. I don't know if anyone else wanted to offer any words.
Mr. Mayor is liaison on planning and zoning, and I couldn't say it any better than you did. So thank you, Linda, very much for all of your service for so many years. And she stepped up every time. We needed her, and just fantastic. So thank you, Linda.
All right. Any others? All right. If there are no others, I would entertain a motion to accept the resignation of Linda Broussard-Vickers.
So moved.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed by the same sign. Motion carries. The next item is item number 3, and I guess we can combine these two. I don't think I'll get into too much trouble doing that. The appointment of Planning and Zoning Commissioners Matt McCabe and Jeannie Cipolla. Did I get that?
Cipolla.
Cipolla?
Yeah.
Cipolla. All right, Cipolla. Thank you for that edit. I was hoping I didn't mess that up. Did you have an opportunity? I've met Matt before. I have not met Jeannie.
Yeah. You're directing.
Yes, me, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, we had 3 qualified candidates interviewing last planning and zoning meeting, and all 3 of them were very well qualified. Interesting, 3 months ago, we would have loved to have any one of those 3, and then at the one meeting we have the 3. So no, we all qualified folks. Ms. Cipolla is in the finance industry, the banking industry, and they all had their strengths and have their strengths, and we just had 2 good candidates coming on board, and with the 3rd one that hopefully will apply again and look at other commissions and committees. So
spectacular. All right. Well, I would entertain a motion for the approval of the appointments of Matthew McCabe and Jeannie
Cipolla.
Cipolla.
So moved.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed by the same sign. Motion carries. All right. Now we have the appointment of Parks and Rec Committee member Katya Port. I get that one right?
Yes.
All right. That one's yours, right?
It's mine.
All right. Yes. Any other comments to add?
She's the young lady who brought forth the pictures and stuff from the parks, showing where we needed some repairs and stuff. And she, I think she's going to bring a very unique perspective. She's only been around for a couple of years.
Two or three years.
And when she came in for the interview, she talked about where she had gone to school and stuff like that. And she is from overseas. And like I said, I think she'll bring a very unique, very good perspective to the Park and Rec Committee.
Awesome. All right. With that, we'll entertain a motion for the appointment of Katya Port.
So moved.
We have a motion. Do we have a second? We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Motion carries. I want to thank all three of them for stepping up and joining our commissions, and look forward to meeting you face to face and thanking you in person. All right, as we move on into our agenda this evening, we next have the approval of the minutes from our February 3rd, 2024 City Council special meeting. Special meeting. It was special. I was there. Does any council members have any items, any annotations for those minutes?
Mr. Mayor, we did catch one, and I think maybe one of the council members caught it too. That, unfortunately, we had Councilmember King listed on the attendee list, and of course that was Councilmember Sweeney in his place.
Yes. Any other changes or annotations? All right. Do we have a motion for approval of the February 3rd, 2024 minutes?
So moved.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second. These are special meeting minutes.
Special meeting minutes.
Special.
Those. Yes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Motion carries. Next, we have our February 28th of 2024 City Council work session and meeting minutes. Any council members have any changes to those? I heard some rumblings before the meeting.
Just under the council reports, this was our junior council member Sauber had talked about, reported that the boys swimming and dive team were at state, not at stated.
Huh? Yes, they were at state. Because stated would not be the right competition.
Yeah. And Mr. Mayor, that was, if I may, Terry, that was page 22 in the packet.
Marcus.
Yeah, it's under council reports number 2.
All right. Any other changes?
You know, Mr. Mayor, if I may, I had one on page 23 of the packet under the North Metro Communications update. And, you know, when I'm reading through that, and under the Telecommunications Commission update, it says mayor reported that they spoke. And I think it should be highlighted that it is Mayor Love reported that they spoke. And I maybe a little bit of a technicality, but I think it's important that that's clear.
Love and love. We'll take it. All right.
Expect out of the for the office.
Just loving the name.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We'll take it.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
All right. Any other changes for the meeting minutes? Hearing none, do we have a motion for approval with the noted changes?
So moved.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Motion carries. Does any council members want to have any items pulled from the consent agenda for further discussion? All right, hearing none. Would anyone like to make a motion for approval of the consent agenda as presented?
So moved.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Motion carries. All right, we move into new business, and new business item number 1 is zoning code changes. First reading, Chapter 156, Table of Allowed Uses. Administrator Stotts.
Mr. Mayor and Council, what's in front of you tonight is something we held a public hearing on at the Planning and Zoning Commission recently. It's some minor changes to Chapter 156, minor in that there's a few of them. One of them just appeared to be a typographical error that for many years our R2 district has not allowed duplexes, and for many years our R2A has allowed them, and that was backwards on the table, and so we wanted to correct that as soon as we could. That's why you're seeing just this little snippet of the zoning code changes come before you, because I need to get that in place soon, because we have a pending building permit with regard to that. So other changes to 156 are forthcoming, just in around that same topic though, in terms of some language and that kind of things, more just clarifications, but we wanted to give those a little bit more time to be worked out. But this one we wanted to move forward as quickly as possible, and we're not suggesting that you skip the second reading, but just that we get this on the books as the first reading and give it a second reading next time.
Mark, that was going to be my question. Obviously we do like to
have a first and a second reading, but will it impact timing whatsoever?
I don't think so. I think we could wait the 2 weeks to the next meeting. So.
Okay. Any other questions in reference to this item? All right, we do not need to make a motion tonight since this is our first reading. If anyone else has any questions that come up between now and the next reading when we will vote on it, please bring those forth. All right, moving on to new business item number 2, resolution voicing opposition to proposed legislation preempting local zoning. Sherry's thoughts.
Mr. Mayor and Council, as Mr. Mayor and Councilmember Taylor and Junior Councilmember Sauber are all aware, we were at the Capitol last week, had an opportunity to chat with both our state representative and our state senator, as well as just a couple minutes with the governor, which was pretty cool. But we spent a good amount of time with our two representatives, I'll call them, I guess one's a senator, but our folks down at the legislature, and talking through a couple of bills which are concerning in that they preempt local zoning. And this is something that has been, it's been threatened before, I'll call it, in terms of there's been other bills before that have looked at having the state preempt zoning laws. And what I mean by preempt meaning the state sets some rule that says cities shall not say that you can't have this kind of house or that kind of house, or that the state shall say that you have to have allow this kind of setback or that kind of setback, or this size of house or that size of house, or this size of lot or that size of lot. All the things we hold dear as a city in terms of a zoning code, and then also just where in terms of a zoning map, a comprehensive plan. And so these bills don't just dip their toe into that water, they dive right in. And as if you had a chance to read through them, they're very very invasive to cities' zoning codes, and again, I think more importantly, just to our overall thoughtful, comprehensive plan. And you know, we're, as a staff and my colleagues at other cities, we're very concerned that this bill has bipartisan support, and that usually means it moves forward, because we have a divided legislature, and anytime you can add to your vote total by going across the aisle, it means you can have a few detractors on your side and still make it through. So it's concerning, because these things will have wide-ranging effects on how we govern our city. And I think the importance of this is really borne out in what we're hearing from residents on some of the proposals we have in front of us. You know, we're getting comments from members of the public saying, you know, I don't care for this proposed development because of this and this and this. And, you know, some of those concerns have to do with our comprehensive plan and whether or not this type of development is allowed in this area or not. And those things would be all out the window, and we'd have to tell our residents, sorry, there's nothing we can do. The state says we have to allow this here. So, that being said, I haven't given you any of the picture of the other side of that coin. Why is this bill being proposed? And it's purported to try to solve the housing crisis, I'll call it. And not just affordable housing, but just housing in general, with an emphasis on making housing affordable. But there's just a shortage of housing units in general across the metro, and really this is a nationwide problem that is affecting us as well. And by having a shortage of housing units in general, there's a trickle-down effect that all makes it the bottom end of those homes unaffordable. And so the idea is these changes that the state wants to make, or the sort of the intervention they want to make, is to say, cities, you can't be saying that there's a minimum house size. You can't be saying that there's a minimum lot size. Or if you can, those sizes are much different than what you currently think. And they want to say that in a single-family neighborhood, you have to allow duplexes or triplexes or quadplexes, or up to, some of the bills said up to 8-plexes. And you know, so there's certainly, you can see, think of your residential neighborhood that we have a lot of, sort of single-family detached residential neighborhoods. Single-family home, single-family home, single-family home, 8-plex, single-family home. It just doesn't, the look and the feel of that is one issue. And then there's myriad other issues such as, can our infrastructure support that? Does our sewer and water capacity support those things? You know, what about our schools? Our schools aren't prepared for, you know, the school calls me every year to see, what are you guys doing for development? We want to make sure we are planning for those new families coming in. This throws planning out the window, and it just says, you know, we talked about population 5,000. How about population 10,000? You know what I mean? Okay. It would literally prevent us from controlling our population in terms of how what we want our full build-out to look like. You know, I mean, obviously that's a stretch that we're not going to have a duplex on every lot. But, you know, it's not out of this world to think this might add 1,000 or 2,000 people to us, especially if it's in state law, and it's not necessarily easy to put the toothpaste back in the tube on some of those things. So I'm not one to fear-monger on, and oh, change is bad, and everything that changes something is evil. But this is, in my 20-some years in the watching this kind of stuff, this is as aggressive as I've seen anything in this genre. And I'm concerned about it, and I think a lot of other city officials are as well.
Even parking restrictions.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't mention that. A lot of the language says, you can't tell a developer how much parking they need. Well, you know, that doesn't sound real good to most people. This is all in the name, again, of like they think this will reduce the cost of housing. They'll reduce the cost because then a developer won't have to build more parking than they need. There's a feeling out there, there's a narrative out there that cities are the reason, the city regulation, city overreach, city fees, city red tape is the reason housing prices are high. And that stripping away that red tape will lower the cost of housing. And if there's a grain of truth in that, I would say that you're squeezing blood out of a turnip, and you might squeeze a percent or two on the cost of a house out. But we all know the real reason housing costs are high is supply and demand, and you know,
labor,
interest rates, and cost of construction, you know, those types of things, right? Which are vastly outweigh any, you know, the cost of a parking space or a, you know, those type of things. So. It's very concerning, and I'm concerned because it's moving through the legislative process right now, and that's why we brought it to you right away, and we have a request in front of you to endorse a resolution opposing the bills. I'm open to language changes. This is not something I grabbed from the league or anything like this. I just wrote this myself, and so I'm very open to additional language or changes to the language.
Darren?
I was just going to ask, did they identify what's causing the housing shortage?
You know, I'm not aware that there's any real studies that they're basing these bills on. I think it's a lot of it's pressure from builders' lobbies. So the building companies, your larger, you know, national builders, labor unions that are representing, you know, carpenters and workers that work in houses. They think, again, that the shortage or the lack of new building permits being issued has to do with, again, all this red tape in the city. And if we could just cut that red tape, then we'd be good to go. It's well intended, but it's just not the solution.
Others? Other questions?
I'll go next, but did you get a comment from our two representatives, our state senator?
Yeah, I'll you know, don't want to put words in their mouth, but I would say that Representative Engen was very supportive of our position and did not understand why this bill had bipartisan support. So Representative Engen is a Republican, and I think he at least expressed to us that he would help oppose this. You know, being in the minority party, there's a limited amount he can do. But again, you know, any of his colleagues that are looking to support this, I think you would be willing to have a conversation with those people. The other thing that both legislators said they would certainly do was, you know, and the League of Minnesota Cities, unfortunately, I think, is in a position where they don't think they can stop this. They think they can only attempt to, you know, sort of, for lack of a better term, water it down. And so we did discuss, like, okay, if we had to accept this, but we could whittle away at it, what are our priorities? And some of the things we talked about were, you know, the minimum size of a house isn't necessarily that important to us, you know. I mean, if someone wants to build a bit of a smaller house, I think our culture has begun to accept that as a viable alternative. The size of a lot, maybe next up on that list, but the things like parking and, you know, needing to show that your infrastructure supports it, and those, you know, absolutely not, right? So then Senator Gustafson, who's a Democrat, expressed empathy towards our concerns, and I think she hears them and is hearing them from a number of her constituents and city constituents. But she's also hearing, I think, more than Representative Engen, she's hearing from the labor groups that are saying, we need this, we need the jobs, we need the construction to continue, we need the cost of construction to come down. And so she's weighing, I think, I'm hearing this from both constituents' perspectives, how do I find a place in the middle? Again, I don't want to put words in both their mouths, but I think Senator Gustafson was hesitant to say she was going to fix this.
Well, and I guess my concern there is I look at our representatives, and they're voted in by the people they represent, not by the labor unions, and I guess fundamentally speaking. So I would think they would want to represent their constituents' concerns, not the big lobby groups. And that's just my opinion, how I see it. And, you know, but this does concern me, because we just lose control of who or what we are, and all these things we hear talk about, we like our small city and all these other things, as to what you were alluding to, Mark, it's gone. And it just doesn't mean anything anymore. We could do away with their planning and zoning commission just about. What would we need them for? So I think supply and demand is a big thing, and not to make a big issue out of this, but it's in the news just every day. It's being talked about. It's a big concern for the presidential election coming up. We've let 7 to 10 million people in over the border, and I brought this up with our county representative here not too long ago. That certainly is going to put pressure on the demand for housing. When you got 10 more people, you got a house. So I don't know. I guess to me it's a concern, and I just feel like we are really losing our identity here, and who and what we are, and what our representative system is all about. It's getting bulldozed right on over, and that concerns me, not just with this, but what's the next thing. So thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you, Mark.
Any others? Does anyone have any changes they would like to see made to the resolution voicing opposition?
Please, Ray. I'm not sure if we can work something in. I was trying to figure out a good way, but if you felt appropriate to add another whereas, because we like whereases.
Yeah.
Alluding to that we would fear in a aging community with aging homes that would create an inopportune or an opportunity for bad actors to prey on property types, reducing the affordable housing currently available.
Yeah, I think thank you, Rhea. That's a good point. Okay. You know, if you want exact wording, we could try to work that out now, or you could, you know, make a motion to approve the resolution contingent on the administrator, you know, working on some language alluding to that. I think just to expand on what Councilmember Taylor is talking about is that there's an unintended consequence here that we can see, that you can all see, is that if the duplex, triplex thing was part of this, right, and all of a sudden every single family home out there was up for grabs to home flippers, that would come in, bulldoze that house, and build a duplex. Well, the first ones they're going to look at are the lowest price ones, right? I mean, they're not going to bulldoze a $750,000 house to put up a duplex. They're going to bulldoze a $125,000 house and put up a duplex.
They wouldn't even have to bulldoze them. They can just split
them. Or
a lot of the houses, the way they're set up, you could easily split them into a duplex.
And as we're seeing with one of the properties in our town, right? Our zoning allowed that, or we chose to allow it. Because it would be in a particular situation, but that was on a 1 acre lot, you know. And so what the unintended consequence is that you may eliminate the affordable housing by buying up let's say a $200,000 house and building two $400,000 houses on that same property, what have you accomplished? Even if you build two $250,000 houses on that property, you really have taken away the truly affordable houses. Because in reality, it is very difficult to just simply build affordable housing. Brand new housing, no matter how small and how modest, just isn't typically affordable. Nobody comes out of college and buys a brand new house. That just doesn't work that way, you know. And so by eliminating aging housing stock, you eliminate those opportunities for people right out of school, just starting their lives, or maybe their first time home buyers, young families, eliminate that opportunity to buy a fixer-upper, quote unquote, right? And the less fixer-uppers we have, the less opportunities there are for those folks to do that. So,
would that be duplicative of the fourth whereas? I think we already alluded to it somewhat, at least in the copy I have.
I think more what I would say is alluding to the fact that like an established community versus some of the newer cities that are all new build, that our community in particular would suffer more from gentrification.
The line that talks about the raising.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't mention that.
I know what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to just add something to the end of this, whereas that says, especially in communities with aging housing stock.
Yeah. That would probably be excellent.
Sure.
Dan, did you have something?
I had a couple things. You know, we got the contact sheet on our app and all that stuff. You know, we got you, Mayor, us, all of us are listed. Do we have Gustafson listed up there as our representative? And if not, can we put her on there so we can make some contacts? And then the people that are interested in this can maybe, you know, voice their concerns, if you will.
Yeah.
And then this is only for Minnesota, correct, that we're speaking of? Because they want to go to, like, Martha's Vineyard and knock something down and put up a affordable housing for those people.
Right.
Or for other people, I should say.
Right.
Not those people. So, excuse me. No, I was just wondering that. And I think if we got her contact information on our city website, at least.
Yeah, we can do that.
Is that a good? I don't know.
Should put both of them on.
I was just going to say we should.
Yeah,
both.
Yeah. And many cities do that. They'll put, you know, and even up to the federal level. But in this case, this is not a federal issue. But we'll put our other groups.
We're going to do that. Then we should also put our county representative.
As
well. So just to make sure we're being equitable. Yep. All right. Any others?
Mr. Mayor, one other follow up. How do we let residents know of this? Is this something we can put on our website, or I don't know? How do we promote that and let our people know that their voices need to be heard? And maybe we put this work this in somehow at our 25th open house.
Yeah. Councilor Rutkowski, I think that's certainly possible. I would want the council to direct staff through some sort of vote to do that. I think it's difficult if you start picking out legislation and putting warning, you know, on your website that this is going to be bad for us, because I think then you get one or two council members that are directing staff to do that, and boy, it can get political real quick, right? And so as much as it seems like there's unanimity here, I would want the council to direct staff to do that if we're going to do that. And the message on the website would be something like, the city council wants you to be aware of this legislation and has these concerns, or, you know.
Yes, Dan.
Can you put that out in this letter?
In the
monthly letter?
Our admin report, certainly.
I mean, is there a vote coming up on this thing, or is it already passed, or where are we at with it?
I believe it might have been in committee today.
In committees,
yeah.
So there's a little urgency to it. I don't know if we have the time to wait for another newsletter or even her open house. I mean, there's an urgency to get this out fairly quickly. I'm assuming the audience of this, we're going to forward it to our representatives.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. All right. Any other wordsmithing or any other comments in reference to the resolution?
I guess I can just say, because I'm quiet over here, but being there, just when we were talking about this in the introduction to the Capitol Day, there was a lot of audible disagreement you could hear. Mm-hmm. And it's disappointing then that it seems like most cities don't want this, but there's this bipartisan support up top that's going to almost make this happen. So I think us voicing our opposition to this is going to be a good thing, especially given our very specific concerns with this bill. So. And like hearing about it there, I was like, this sounds, everyone was kind of like, this is crazy. And then when I was reading through it today, I was like, kind of just like, whoa, the whole time. Because I read through everything that was in here. And it's just kind of one thing after another that seems like it's stepping on local government's toes. And I think there's other ways to add affordable housing, other ways to incentivize construction without, I don't remember who said the word, bulldozing over, yeah, planning, zoning, and yeah, everything else. So
Avery is correct. As we were in the league conference, we actually had the author of the bill up on the stage, yeah. And they were being questioned, and you could hear audible groans in the audience in opposition of her stated position. It was not a very comfortable situation. And to credit the league, I mean, everyone knows I support the league, but our IGR person was really, really very pointed, asking great questions, really pushing back hard, even though there was this realization of, like Mark said, there's bipartisan support, so this probably has a pretty good chance of going through. But really just hammering away on the individual points of it, why it's not good, what could be changed about it, how to at least make it better. And to give Senator Gustin some credit, she did say to us, I do listen to the league. You know, I can't do everything the league tells me to do, but I do listen to what they tell me. So if there are things that are very specific that need to be changed in this bill, I'm not going to say that I'm not going to support it, but I definitely would be in support of hearing those items. So she did at least give us that much before we walked out of the room. But, I don't think anything that I've heard from any of you guys was incorrect. It's very accurate.
Mr. Mayor and Council, I did just attempt to add the language from Councilmember Taylor into this whereas, so I'll just read the whole whereas. Whereas, while well-intended, these bills and others which seek to solve the housing crisis by allowing the construction of duplex, triplex, and larger multiplexes in traditional single-family neighborhoods will have unintended negative consequences, especially in cities with aging housing stock, incentivizing the raising of existing affordable single-family homes in order to build a duplex with two homes, each more expensive than the one they replaced.
I would just change, especially in cities like Centerville, with aging housing stock. But I do like that, thank you.
All right. Any other council members have any other changes that they would like to see? All right, would anyone like to make a motion for approval?
Motion for approval as amended.
All right, we have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All right, hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign? Motion carries. Thank you all. All right, we're going to move into staff and council updates. We're going to start with Administrator Stotts.
The headline, of course, is our junior council member's encounter with this guy she met in St. Paul.
And, lucky you.
Happens to be our governor. And we had a nice little, I don't know, 3-4 minute chat with him. And it was an excellent opportunity to meet and greet. And I think just overall it was a great day to be out and about in St. Paul and meet our legislators and see how that process works a little bit. And, just so happens we had some pretty meaty topics to talk about. And unfortunately, I think, in the brief time we had with each of them, we probably had 10 other things we would have liked to have talked about, but this was really so important. Comparatively to other things that we didn't get a chance to, but it was a great opportunity to build our relationships, and this is now a couple, 4 or 5 times that I've met each of them. They know my face and name, and certainly yours now as well.
And so we hope we can continue that nice dialogue, because it's good to have people working for you that know your name and face and can know that you're a trusted voice. So got lots of other things we got opinions about. We'll get to those as soon as we get this problem solved. So, now the legislature's in progress, and it's a short session this time around, and it's going to go quickly, and there's lots of stuff on the agenda. So anyone that has any questions about any other legislation, please let me know. If you hear something on the news about a proposed bill or something, please let me know and I can take a quick look at it, what's going on. And the League does a great job, and so does, you know, we're a part of Metro Cities and Minnesota Small Cities. They both give us about weekly updates, especially during the session, on bills of note, and here's what's happening. And what do they say, about 3,500 pieces of legislation that are out there? You know, most of them won't make it to the floor, right? But they're never known, so. Of course, we have, it's 2 weeks away yet, but our town hall open house on Monday, March 25th, from 5 to 8 p.m. in the City Hall chambers here. We'll have a number of different little stations set up for people to come and converse with city council members and staff and the developer of the Lalonde proposal. So we've got a number of different topics we want to hear from people on. Hopefully we can get you signed up for our civic engagement platform, and you know, get a lot of different, we want to hear your voice. Just like we were talking to the legislators, this is your opportunity to come and talk to your local legislator, right? So that open house is coming up in about 2 weeks, just under 2 weeks. And then immediately the next night, same time, same channel, we have the open house for the corridor study on 20th Avenue, and that's an important one as well. They've got two sort of proposed layouts. Sort of one is sort of a, what if we had roundabouts at, you know, the major intersections, and the other one says, what if we didn't? And it kind of lays out the layouts of the corridor with sort of both those dueling concepts, and it's an interesting study in the design of that. And we submitted some formal comments from the engineering department today, and our public works guys weighed in on that as well. And I also forwarded the drawings directly to our businesses along that corridor. I kind of snipped out pieces that are close to them and asked them to comment, gave them personal emails to say, please make sure you can attend this meeting. So I'm hoping we'll get a good representation from them, because a lot of it is impactful to them. You know, whether there's a median or their entrance is being combined with somebody else's, or there's a roundabout near you, or, you know, those type of things. So the design of it is important to the future of our city, and also the timing of it, right? Is this getting done next year? Is this getting done 5, 10, 15 years from now? So all those things are very important to us.
What were the thoughts of our engineer?
It's a mixed bag. I think there are some spots where roundabouts really make sense. I think, you know, in very general terms, roundabouts do a nice job of letting people know they're coming into an area that is going to be more urban setting and lower speeds. And that we heard a lot in the first open house about people, you know, wanting to lower the speed. And so having a roundabout sort of on the south end and the north end to kind of say, all right, you're done being in the country, it's time to come to Centerville now. It might not be a bad spot for those. But in other spots, it's a bit much, and I think we can do without. And these roundabouts do take a fair amount of property and are a bit cumbersome. And well, you know, personally, I don't mind roundabouts. Anyone, I think, that drives through 4 or 5 in a row, you know, in a 1 mile stretch, you start to get a little sick of them, right? So they have their place, right? And they're tried and true in terms of reducing accidents and keeping traffic moving and all that kind of stuff. But I think there's a time and place for each one of those instances. So, yeah, in general, it was a sort of a mixed bag of comments that right here might be good, over here not so much. Like the medians here, don't like them there, that kind of thing. So,
Russ?
Mr. Mayor, Mark, if I may, is there a traffic count when they say, yeah, at a minimum, where they're going to put or a maximum, or we're going to put traffic lights or a roundabout? I mean, if you got 2,000 cars a day, a roundabout's great, but if you got 10, traffic lights, what?
Yeah, I'd love to package it up that answer up into a little ball and tell it to you right now. But it, what it's called is an ICE, an ICE, used to be called an SJR, a signal justification report. Now it's called an intersection, evaluation.
Control.
Intersection control, thank you. Intersection control evaluation. Look at you.
Engineer.
And so that what that means is that you're evaluating for signal, roundabout, or two-way stop, four-way stop. You're all different types of controls and being evaluated at once. And so the sort of the signal things are still out there in terms of there's 9 justifications that need to be met. 3 of them need to be met to justify a signal. And then roundabouts have the same kind of a framework, like, well, if there's this much or that much. Usually the deciding point in terms of whether or not you use a roundabout versus a signal is the side traffic. So if you get the main drag that you're talking about has 10,000 cars a day, and the side one has 20 cars a day, not so much a roundabout, probably a signal, because you want to keep the main drag moving. If it's 10,000 cars a day and 5,000 and 6,000, well, then, you know, when all the legs are getting close to being equal, then a roundabout works a lot better, because you don't want to have a signal that has all these yellow lights that just waste time when the intersection's not moving anybody. And so it really has nothing less to do with the amount of traffic and more to do with the equality of the legs of the intersection. So the more equal those are, the more likely a roundabout works best.
Thank you.
Of course, I could probably go there and find out a little bit more, but south of there in that business district where Sutton and all that stuff is that the one that's being looked at?
So Fairview looks like we are going to want to realign that to line up with Center Street, and you'll notice that that's why Amazon's parking lot is kind of a funny shape there in that southwest corner. Fairview would be realigned to line up with Center Street. We would not, the current plan does not show a roundabout at that spot. A roundabout would either be at Cedar, so where the Public Works garage is, or down at Birch Street, where Inlino Lakes. But right now, Fairview, and it does not have a roundabout. There is a proposal on one of the things to have a roundabout at Commerce Drive instead. So that would be a spot for a potential roundabout there. So.
It seems like when you put the roundabouts out where heavy semi-traffic is, which would be over there, you always see it scraped up and, ran over and all that stuff. And then they got to slow down and speed up and they're loud. And
yep.
Then the dumb trucks back there with their J-brakes and all that stuff,
Yeah.
Noisy.
Anytime you have a controlled intersection, you can have that noise of acceleration is not, it's a...
Right, but
a real thing, yep.
Those trucks usually can kind of time it when they're going down, seeing the one turn yellow and the
right.
one, and not, slow away down. Sometimes, not
yep.
all the time.
Yep.
But a roundabout, you have to get down to
yeah,
very
you have
minimum.
To accelerate and, yep, and decelerate, yep.
So, I was just wondering where they're putting them in or what the thought process is, where they think they're needed and stuff.
Yeah, right now, the proposed roundabouts would be at 73rd on the north end, and then Commerce Drive, Cedar Street, and Birch. So those are that's in the roundabout concept. In the non-roundabout concept, there are no roundabouts. So.
All right. Good.
Elections. I just want to, take an opportunity to thank our city clerk Teresa Bender, who did an awesome job along with her. Election judges in running the presidential primary, presidential nominating primary, the 45 days prior to it that she had to have a voting booth set up here. And I think, what did she say? We had it was a very low number of people that voted in that 45 day period. But we were here, we were ready to serve, and obviously that number will go up with the broader primary in the fall and of course the election in November. So again, just thanks to the long weeks leading up to it, long day there, and making sure we had accurate and well-run elections. So the Public Works Department, we are hiring. We have an open position posted for the for both the permanent position on our public works staff and as well as our summer seasonal help. So if you know anyone that's interested in that, we'd be glad to hear from them. We do have a number of applicants already for the public works technician job, and so we're grateful for a number of good qualified candidates that we have. And that closes April 22nd, so that's the set closing date for that job opportunity. The public works seasonal stuff, we would like to see those applications as soon as possible, but generally we leave that open until we fill it, until we fill the four positions. So, if you weren't aware, the state has, actually the federal government has put out a national lead service line mandate, and a lot of minutiae here that I won't go into, but essentially you have to inventory all your service lines, including the lines that are on private property from the curb stop into the home. And luckily for us, Centerville has a pretty modern set of infrastructure. We don't have any lead service lines. And so we were one of the first cities to be able to submit our information to the state. And so we're kind of off and running on that. The idea is that there's going to be a GIS system that you'll be able to click on any person's house and say, that person has a lead. And, you know, I think the idea is if you're going to buy a house, you want to know, mm-hmm. is there a lead service line there? So it's about transparency to the public. Got some information here about Anoka County Community Social Services in the Centerville Cares. And this stems from our Anoka County Government Officials meeting we had a while back. And I just wanted to pass on some of that information that was presented there. I think it's just a great reminder that we do have a lot of services available. Just a matter of sometimes getting people in touch with the right folks. So, right. Got a new Parks Committee member. Got a couple of new, we have a couple of new business owners. One is at NY Liquors, and we want to thank the new owners there for moving in and taking over that business, and we think they're going to be a great fit. And we have Max Storage that's getting their due here with the Center Stage program. They are now open for business and renting out their spots. I think they still have a couple left, so give them a call if you have an opportunity there. They've got a nice setup there. So, there was another Metro Water Supply Planning Workshop that I attended last week or the week before. Last week, I think. Again, this was the meeting of the meetings, and so we were conglomerating all the sub-regional groups into one and kind of trying to find some commonality there. So again, that process is continuing. Got another CLPD officer, and just one position left to go before we're fully staffed. And I just wanted to throw up here the most recent iteration of the Lalonde proposal. This apartment rendering here is just, again, this is not a final version or anything, but they wanted to show us what they're looking at for that sort of corner piece to add some accent to it. They're looking at trying to give a nod to the old elementary school that used to be in the same region. I'm trying to piece together where it was, but saw an old historic photo actually a couple days ago that really looked like it was basically in the school parking lot. At Main and Centerville Road, they're just you can see the kind of the dormer from the old school is kind of what they're trying to mimic here with their dormers up here, or gables, I should say. So obviously a lot more stuff to think about in terms of details and architecture there, but that's kind of the direction they're going. I think it's a neat idea to give a nod to the old school, given that they're right next to the existing school. So, then we did hear from Sharper Homes, who is, if you don't recall, 2017 was the first time they proposed the 24-unit detached townhome development on the 19 acres in the northeast corner of town. And they brought that back to us again in 2021, and third time's the charm. So they've submitted an application. We've got a public hearing scheduled, and at the April 2nd Planning Commission meeting, we'll have a public hearing on that development, and if everything goes right, we'll move forward with it. So Old Mill Estates has also been into the Planning Commission for a concept plan review of their third edition. It's a replat of one of the lots, which has some additional area for development. This was already always sort of part of the plan, but now they're coming back to us after having figured out a few things with the power line easements and some wetland issues, and I think they're in a position now to do that. We don't think they'll be ready for the April meeting, but we do anticipate them being probably at the May Planning and Zoning meeting. So with that, I think that's about it.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Stutz? Yes?
On that Old Mill Estates, what was that through road? Is that going to be private or public? Did you figure
it'll just be a private drive, really. It's only going to serve the three homes. It'll be kind of out okay. On an island, so to speak, out in the middle of the...
Because the width isn't very...
Right. We've asked them to make it large enough for a fire truck, and we've got a kind of a parking spot designed for the fire truck to be able to pull in there and still have people get by them. And so we're asking them to put a hydrant out there and put a pull-off spot for a fire lane for the fire department to be able to get their truck out there. But it will not be a city street, yeah. And it won't be anywhere near a city street standard, so that there will be no confusion about whether or not we're ever taking that over.
Just checking.
Yep, yep.
All right. Any others? All right, thanks, Mark. Tansia?
No update.
All right, thank you. Terry?
New committee members, Mr. Stats had mentioned, and Park and Rec had a very lengthy conversation about priorities and what should be done with the parks and what items should take priority. There was discussion about a splash pad, discussion about a playground equipment all being ADA in the city, because it's not a lot of it is ADA, if any. I'm not sure. I haven't been around the parks myself, but yeah, that was the majority of the discussion. So, and like I said, they interviewed Katya.
Important discussion. So, important hearing more about it. All right. Thank you, Darren.
No new meetings. I just wanted to myself thank Linda Sard-Vickers as well, being that I was the chairperson for a few years with her, and her flexibility and her willingness to help and her insights and her knowledge was wealth to our city.
Absolutely. So. Thank you for that. Russ?
Mr. Mayor, we talked planning and zoning. We had a planning and zoning meeting here a little over a week ago, and much of what we talked about that night has been discussed tonight and on our agenda. But we are looking at doing some cleanup on the land use codes, and Mark brought up some of that tonight, but there's more to come too. There's a few more we're going to clean up, right? I think yet to. And then we did have our interviews. We had three really good candidates, and Mr. Gordy Peterson and Jeannie Sepala and Matthew McCabe, all of them very well qualified, and unfortunately we only needed two this time. A while back we could have probably used them all, right? So, but thank you to all of them, and I would encourage Mr. Peterson to come back and keep his eyes and ears open for anything coming up in the future. And as we all stated earlier, again, thank you to Linda for all her years of service. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
All right, thank you. Great.
No reports.
No reports.
Anything you wanted to share about last week at all?
No, I think we covered everything mostly. But it was a lovely day.
All right. Avery?
Okay. I'm going to support
sports.
Okay. So we were talking before about some of the high school wrestlers that were at state. And we had one girl who I think we said lives in Centerville.
We're maybe, pretty sure.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Got third. And then we had a senior boy who got fifth. Okay, for them. Our hockey team was at state last week. Unfortunately, lost in double OT for their first game, but they won the consolation championship. So good for them. Yay. Go Centennial. And then, I don't know. That's the only report for the high school. It's spring break right now, so more to come, hopefully.
All right. Thank you. So my only report that I wanted to talk about a little bit was we did attend City Down the Hill as was noted by Administrator Stott, he, myself, Ray, and also Avery all attended. We were headed to our legislatures, and you know, I had my list of four things I was going to talk about, nice little tidy list, and it was kind of a little bit of a popcorn list, I almost called it, and then this housing thing came up and really just kind of blew it up, and we didn't get a lot of chance, at least with our senator, we didn't get a lot of chance to talk about any of the other items. We did get to talk to about some of the others with, I almost call him by his first name, yes, Representative Ingen. Some of the things I did want to talk about, though, is LGA. We wanted to keep that on the table. We knew LGA was not going to be something that was really focused on this year, but we didn't want it to go away because next year is their opportunity to talk about it. I did start really pushing for regional fire. You know, just my point of, hey, buying a new fire truck is $1 million. You know, can we afford to continue to do that as individual cities or individual departments like we have, that you know, we really need the state to start pushing for where it makes sense to start helping us formalize some of these things. I'm planning to talk about Market Homestead. They raised it a little bit last year to $413,000, which is a nice number, but in our area, you know, $413,000 gets to pretty quickly. I was kind of glad I didn't say that to our senator, because I think she would have turned that around and said, see, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's why we need to do this other thing. So I was glad we didn't get there. But then the one that I was really happy kind of to throw out there and really make offer them opportunity to make it their own was just some kind of legislation to incentivize the junior council program. Because I think it's such a great program that, you know, if the state steps up and says, hey, you know what, And I told them it didn't need to be a lot of money. This could be a small amount of money that had a really big impact. But if the state stepped up and said, we're going to give your city $1,000 for having a junior council member, that allowed other cities to now want to do that, to bring them to City Hill on a day or send them to Washington, D.C. or whatever may be the opportunity just to enrich their program. So I thought it would be a pretty cool idea if we were, as the first city to start it, had our two representatives, which were not bipartisan, from each side of the aisle, come forward together to, you know, bring something. So that was one of the things I pushed. I did want to offer Ray and Avery an opportunity just to share a little bit about some of the things, because Ray had some very good points that she brought up to both representatives. And Avery, I was very proud of her. She really talked to them about her viewpoint and the viewpoint of students in her age group and how they're under... Well, I don't want to say it. I don't allow you guys to say it. So, see the floor to each one of you. Who wants to go first?
Yeah, basically for both Angan and Gustafson, I gave them a rundown of some of the things that I prioritized, some of the things that people my age, people I talked to leading up to this prioritized, and I talked about... Boy, what did I talk about? I talked about a lot of our concerns regarding housing prices, college prices, just being this age, going into that, and the negative outlook of people my age on the future, the price and cost of everything. Also, I talked about educational performances in our public schools, because they aren't what they should be, and a lot of us are noticing that, especially with the grades younger than us, the people moving up through the schooling system. And I talked about the age of our legislators, especially with Engen. I had a more extensive conversation with Engen than I did Gustafson with this, because it's something he's really passionate about how old our legislation is as opposed to the age of the population in the country and the state, in just the district. And so I don't know if I'm missing.
No, you're doing a good job.
I think, yeah. But yeah, I basically just gave them a rundown on priorities of me, priorities of people my age, and hopefully enlightened them a little bit more, even though Engen's my generation, so probably didn't need it as much as maybe Gustafson did. But
he's quite your generation, but closer. Yeah. Much closer than most of us,
yeah.
Yes. Right?
I don't know what I brought up that was unique that we haven't talked about.
Well, you did talk about animal rights and things of that nature.
I think that was the only additional thing other than our mutual city goals that we had discussed with them. To also ask for support for legislation that is also being presented around certifying our veterinary technicians in the field. Currently, that's a whole population of skilled workers who are not validated by actually having legitimate licenses, and they're not also protected. And those are really great working humans that are not able to necessarily make the wage that they're appropriately educated for. And that in and of itself is making housing inaccessible to them. So really trying to reach out to those of our community who are skilled workers to get validated and seen for the worth that they bring to the profession.
And as we try to make our way around, you know, we had Ray as our tour guide to help us find where we needed to go. So that was pretty nice. She has some experience with the building there. Mark kind of knew where he was going, but Ray really knew where she was going. All right. Well, with that, I would entertain a motion for adjournment.
So moved.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign? We stand adjourned. God bless.